You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today, when this goes out, it's going to be the 23rd or 24th of October. And I want to thank you for the donations I received recently. Some of you know exactly who you are in particular, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart. This, of course, is Matthew Raphael Johnson. And just a quick note, I just uploaded a new paper on oligarchy to Patreon. And, of course, I encourage everyone to go over there and subscribe to my page. But there's been some changes over there. It's always been very difficult to answer letters. Everything is very slow. It freezes my computer. I'm not the only one who has this problem. There's been some changes. I think there's been a change in management. And the way it works is that unless I say otherwise, the content is free. Now, none of the content there from me is free. It used to be that you would put whatever you wanted to donate for the month, and that still might be possible. But I have to explicitly say this is a subscription matter, and it's $5. I have no control over that. I didn't want to do that. I'm not sure how it's going to, I mean, nothing's going to change. I mean, if you pay every month, it's going to remain the same. Nothing really matters. I think this has more to do with new followers, new subscribers. So again, I had no control over that. And I thank you for all of you who have, who subscribed to me. If I were independently wealthy, I'd be doing all this for free without the, as I was doing, you know, when I was teaching and years ago, you know, I gave it all away for free. But things have changed, some for the better, some for the worst. Now, as far as today's talk is concerned, this will be, at least in part, not necessarily the whole hour, but it will be in part the final installment of Heidegger, specifically Heidegger and postmodernity. I've tackled that topic on here many times before. I think I had a Baudrillard thing, I maybe even had a Foucault thing here, and then postmodernism more generally. For whatever reason, the postmodern mentality was very easy for me to grasp. It has, as Alexander Dugin says, and he's very concerned with this, it has as many opportunities or possibilities in Heidegger's sense as it does negatives and drawbacks. I think let me just summarize very, very briefly what's happening here and what's happened over the last. Last week, of course, with St. Paisius, the previous 2 weeks. Western thought, and by that he means from the pre-Socratics onward, Greece and Western Europe, has had a philosophical mentality that stresses being above everything. The problem with Heidegger, or for Heidegger, is that the word being is very ambiguous, and it's hard to use in a consistent way without falling into the fallacy of equivocation. By being, we're talking about, you know, starting from the pre-Socratics, that there is a substance, there is a thing that underlies reality. And only in understanding that substance can we understand anything that's going on around us. But of course, there's the problem of our own consciousness. There's the problem of our own upbringing. The society in which we were raised, found most commonly in ethnicity. This is a very vague conception of design for Heidegger. To what extent does the mind affect this being, and vice versa? Is the mind merely this passive stage, like John Locke would say, where the sensations around you just go by without any actions on its own behalf? Or is it just the opposite? Is the will absolutely significant for understanding what this being is? One of the things that began to make war on this was phenomenology. And as the word suggests, it's just a study of phenomena. But phenomena is not necessarily being. Phenomena is an appearance. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's false, but it probably means that it's incomplete. How that appearance came to be, how it came to be generated, and what's its relationship with our own mind and our own will, that's the core of dialectics and hence the philosophy of Hegel. Heidegger, remember, he is a product of the early 20th century, World War I and Weimar. He was a supporter of Hitler for a fairly short time. He sees crisis everywhere. And part of the reason for this is this inability to pinpoint even a definition of being, let alone how do we come to understand it. But even in something like logos, which would be somewhat of an answer to what being is, that still has a certain dependence on our state of mind. Logos to someone who is mired in the passions doesn't mean a whole lot. It might be a formality that you more or less agree with or disagree with, but making it a part of you, your design, is extremely difficult. You know, it seems arbitrary. The world doesn't look the same from the point of view of someone mired in modern malaise and abulia versus someone who is a great ascetic, as Paisius was. And again, I think for all of us, there's a certain formality here because none of us have reached the level of sainthood like Paisius had. And you may note for all the spiritual, monastic, Russian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, philosophical stuff I deal with, it really does come down to what is our state of mind at the time capable of understanding and interpreting and absorbing. But once the debates over what being is wear themselves out, what's left? If you're constantly putting, as phenomenology does, screens or conditions between our intellect on the one hand and objects outside of us on the other hand, it starts getting more and more complicated. Different fields, including things like economics and psychology, constantly impinge on this. What happens is that being will eventually fall away. Nominalism was a huge aspect of this. And we're in the death throes of a civilization that has nothing to do with Greece and Rome, that has nothing to do with the Middle Ages. We're forced to live in a violently revolutionary surveillance state where there is nothing in public that we do that isn't recorded, regulated, and somehow the domain of lawyers. Outside of, you know, work-related talk in an office, you can't say anything. A white man can't say anything. Let me be more specific. An average-looking or unattractive white man. He has to watch everything he said because there's nowhere for him to go. Some of you may have heard of the judge in, I think, Maryland, who, after presiding over a man's divorce, took his house, signed protective orders despite there being no criminal charges or really any rational accusations, and took his kids. This man took matters into his own hands and shot the judge. No one advocates that kind of extremity. Frankly, I think the regime would love it, but we kind of understand how that might unfold. Thank God in my divorce, God, we're going on 10 years now, none of that really happened to me. You know, I felt the pain, and I saw how the courts operated, but I was expecting it. This is the position that the average white man is put in. You could get away with doing that to him since he has nowhere to go. But you think of the rage that must be burning in millions of men in that position who can go to work and even a look can be interpreted as something negative. And the law has been completely rewritten in such a way that it has nothing to do with the mens rea. It has nothing to do with your intent. It has to do with how your actions are perceived and interpreted, which is legally and morally nonsensical. A woman can say anything to you. This is the will to power of the regime. This is what the left has come to. This is what happens when the Great Reset takes the place of the New World Order. And in fact, my paper on the political economy of oligarchy that I just uploaded to Patreon goes into the differences between the New World Order on the one side and the Great Reset on the other. And it's actually not too dissimilar from the difference between modernity and postmodernity. It's both negation of what came before, as well as teasing out the truths of the previous era and trying to succeed where it failed. And those two things exist in a very tense situation. Heidegger is writing in the midst of chaos. The decay of this civilization, even after nominalism fell apart, without anything really to replace it, becomes what we now know as a Great Reset, where open persecution, so long, you know, if you're the right color or whatever, is perfectly acceptable. Where you have a total totalitarian police state, Ukraine, that is considered liberal and democratic by the American government and all the universities. You have the Zionist entity bombing a hospital, and millions of people not only are defending it, but in some cases are terrified to say anything else. As always, these myths and stories rely on the ignorance and the total lack of any historical sense from the collective population, of the collective population. There's been several wars. This spectacle of warfare that's only really occurred since Ukraine and now Israel, where it becomes almost a participatory spectacle, is something fairly new. There's been many wars between Israel and Hamas that never received this kind of attention. Where I think it was a 2006 version, either 2006 or 2008, where the destruction of Gaza was so severe that about half of the Gaza Strip's 40 hospitals, that includes medical clinics, were destroyed. In other words, there's nothing new about this. The Jewish resistance organization came from the Haganah in the 1940s, and establishing the State of Israel, and the Stern Gang, etc., attacked Red Cross convoys and field hospitals all the time. Of course, that's not the Western way of war. I don't care who you are, but it is there, and it's consistent with their Khazar roots. Now, as far as Heidegger is concerned, I don't remember exactly where we left off. But I'm hoping that little summary helps bring us up to speed Heidegger looks forward to a concept of an event that resurrects the older and ethnic understanding of the world, that this alienation and homelessness, as he calls it, can be reversed by this event, by this sudden flash. And as far as Heidegger was concerned, at least for a time, he thought Hitler was that flash of light. And possibly World War I and Weimar, not to mention the establishment of the Soviet Union, created the conditions for an extreme shock to the system. Because of the Western support of the USSR, to the point where, you know, I mean, there's been no historical transportation of money and goods and materiel in history as there was in the Lend-Lease program in the Soviet Union. I don't even know what the value would be today. And of course, all of that was completely written off. Rather than extend the Marshall Plan to them, they did something better. They continued their investment and they forgave all the debt, which was extremely high at that point. So the Soviet Union was subsidized and rebuilt almost exclusively with Western money. That in and of itself can completely alter, that fact completely alters how we view 20th century history. The West was not anti-communist at any level. I mean, you had elements in the establishment that may have been, but not so much that it was Marxist. That had taken over the university, at least during the Vietnam War. And then in the later now, of course, it's enforced. The only time there was ever an issue with the Soviet Union is if it got too big. If they were gathering resources such that they could cut the U.S. out of a trade deal. They fully accepted the dollar as a reserve currency. Unlike Vladimir Putin's Russia, which is under as many sanctions as the West can possibly come up with. Arrest warrant. You know, Stalin never had an arrest warrant on him. Well, Hitler never bombed any hospitals either. He didn't use poison gas in the field, and he didn't use it anywhere else either. Israel does that. So because of the problems inherent in the definition of being, isness, what makes the world around us, or within us, intelligible, we can come to some kind of understanding about, however incomplete, what is that? What makes it such that we can come to an understanding about it? What is it about those things? Beings with a small b. Being, of course, is a capital B. Two different things. Of course, Heidegger has his own answer, but this flash, this event, I mean, we're always seeing things. The rise of Putin in Russia, something like that, can be the event where multipolarity then challenges the utter dominance of liberalism. But Heidegger, again, you're not going to find any grand ideology with him. However, you will find the context for political principles. That's very different, of course, from an ideology. An ideology is essentially a mass phenomenon. An ideology is purely on paper. You don't really have to know much about political science or history to adopt an ideology. You have your ready-made answers to anything. You just have to memorize the points. That's what an ideology does. It's for the masses. It's very easy to absorb. That's not what we're talking about here. Design is a way of life. I have associated it, as has Alexander Dugin, with ethnicity, and hence the language that makes an ethnic group what it is. And by language, I mean any form of communication, whether it be in words or anything else. We'll get to that in a little bit. But his somewhat of an approach to an answer of being is in design. The complete collapse of inner and outer, of external and internal, of the one and the many. The aspect of ethnos that isn't individualist, it isn't collectivist. It isn't unified. It isn't diversified. It doesn't belong to us, but we all possess it. This is the kind of entity, the humanization of the natural world. And I think we ended up the last time talking about the role of poetry. Now, again, when he uses words like that, he means them in general. He's talking about art in general, which could include everything from day-to-day entertainment to music to actual poetry. But poetry, specifically, though, is useful because if the ethnic foundation is language in all senses of that term, the poet takes this language, takes a word, you know, just one aspect of communication, and explodes it. It gives it a use way beyond its normal dictionary definition. Remember, the problem with dictionaries is that they don't really tell you what a word is. They tell you how a word is used. When you have Ebonics in the Oxford English Dictionary, no NetSpeak is there. It doesn't tell you what a word means. It tells you how it's used at the moment, even if it's completely opposite to what it used to mean. The ethnos, one way to put it is it's the collective unconscious manifest through history. And history and poetry and art do this. Take what is hidden and bring it to light, which is something that approaches the truth of the matter. The subconscious is overcome, and what was hidden in the subconscious is brought into awareness. You know how important this was to people like Carl Jung. What Heidegger calls the destiny of the truth of being is precisely this process. But along with the idea of the event, and I think I did mention this last time, is the idea of destruction. You know, of course, in his German, that the errors of the past, of course, we're talking about, you know, Marxism and liberalism and nominalism, have to be challenged. And as I mentioned last time, one of the ways to challenge it is to find the real meaning of these words. Now, ethnos, like the Russian narod, is not just any collection of people. The Greek term, the Russian term, it's the root of the word comes down to behavior, custom, what's considered acceptable, either in a broad sense or a very specific sense. Destruction for Heidegger, he uses the example of Martin Luther. Now, just taking his word for it here, Martin Luther said there's been so many accretions in the Church of Rome, things that were never in the ancient church. And they just built up and built up and built up and took a life of their own. And now it's unrecognizable. Destruction in this case is a creative thing. And that's what Martin Luther at least thought he was doing, or how he was interpreted. His behavior was interpreted this way. Design is not objective. It's not subjective. But one of the aspects is the metacultural world, what Losov would call the mythic aspects of our society. Myths, of course, are symbolic. They're not literal truth. A myth is essential to society and every part of it, and that it references design. But it's also very fanciful in its detail. It isn't so much what we think is true or false or what we think is right and wrong. It's what has to exist for us to even come to any of those conclusions in the first place. What understandings have to exist? We also talked about the concept of dwelling. Dwelling is the life within authenticity with reference to ethnic history. Now, let me pause here. I want to go back to an article I wrote many years ago, 2010, I think it was. And I wanted to list out what an ethnic group is. In other words, what's the foundation of the nation? The nation is not a civic entity. It's not the state. It's not its borders. It's its community, unified by language and religion, a sense of belonging, And we know that liberalism is perpetually at war with that. In the Jewish mind, their victory is through cohesion and double standards, certainly not numbers. And in that sense, they should be admired in a diabolical kind of a way. The concept, and this is not from Heidegger, the concept of reciprocity. It's the concept of rights and duties not being abstractions, but rights and duties as integrated within a community, a specific way of life. Nothing, no social arrangement, no privilege, no institution, no right is ever abstract. Abstractions, there's a freedom of speech with nothing else. There's freedom of assembly with no other conceptions of what your duties are in that regard and how, is it for the common good or not. Error doesn't have rights. Abstractions are the result of laziness, intellectual dishonesty. But reciprocity is another aspect of social communication. We don't communicate anymore because we don't share a vocabulary. We're not speaking the same language, both literally and figuratively. Reciprocity is precisely engaging in rights in such a way that it reflects its duties to the common good. The make-believe, absolute fake debates that the press engages in are structured with a view to sensationalism and to promote an agenda, not any conception of truth or coherence. For something to be a community, it has to have ethnic markers. And that's really what a constitution is, at least in its traditional definition. That's the much older German and continental concept of the state. Normally, the term state refers, we use the state does X. We're talking about the administration, coercive body. No. Reading Hegel, you come across the idea that the state is what I call the cultural scaffolding upon which any institution might rest. The low populated agrarian, highly aristocratic American Republic doesn't exist anymore. There are very few yeomen. Therefore, what the Constitution rests upon no longer exists. And that explains why it's a dead letter and everyone ignores it. But the ethnic community, where design, really this is being, and design is an expression of this, specifies the nature and function of duties, rights, and rewards. It's what distinguishes the national community from everything else. And these institutions derive from a specific experience of a group of people. And of all people, at least in their public pronouncements, Jews are well aware of this. It's just not for us. Without understanding the historical foundation of our institutions, the true meaning of these things, we don't understand them. We end up referring to things dogmatically rather than critically. And this is why communities are different from one another. Their historical experience is different. Their resources, their social condition, economic life, their geography. These create different types of people with different priorities. And especially as they develop over time. Native people, foreign peoples are fairly easy to identify. And that's kind of implied anytime they use the word community at all. The ability of one group, the group of overarching political significance, to identify outsiders is proof of the internal cohesion of a community. Demonizing that, of course, is total destruction. We talked about what happens when the concept of being fails to be defined. When debates simply gutter out in liberalism and nominalism are a surrender. They're manifestations of social decay. The fact that people defend these as goods, assuming that they even say that, is strange. Universally, it was seen as decay. Now, because of its financial connections and connections with other groups of people, it is considered a good that we have to pursue. But within this ethnic community, there are traditions. A community doesn't exist without them. And these are basic foundational sentiments, for lack of a better word. That's the context for any communication, for any activity of any significance whatsoever. Traditions of political significance are means whereby peoples have maintained cohesion, especially in times of crisis. And Heidegger certainly is writing in a time of crisis. Heidegger also vehemently hated liberalism. I call it the infrastructure of security. Membership is not the same as citizenship. Membership is active, while citizenship is really ascribed to us because we're born in a certain place. Membership implies a concrete relation, but citizenship is an abstraction, at least in modern governments. The opposite of that, bad faith, dasmal, can be found among other places in the idea of cosmopolitanism. That's an invention of the empires, of international capital. It's the most artificial and abstract of all social categories. It has no inherent content. And yet, it's the official ideology of what used to be the Western world. It serves the interests of this regime, which by its very structure is globalized. That has a lot to do with profit and destroying any foundation for revolt. But these abstract categories, they're abstract for a reason. They're alien to us. And that gutters out in the isolated ego, what Heidegger calls homelessness or alienation, that somehow the ego believes itself autarkic, doesn't even know it has responsibilities until it's incorporated into an ethnic unit. The mass man only knows force. In reality, of course, the isolated ego does not and cannot exist. It's a contradiction. And yet it's taken for granted. We're not even talking about governments here. We're talking about the foundations upon which they might be built. Design, being, ethnos. Ethnos as the expression. It's a substratum upon which a state can be constructed. And government is different from a state. Of course, today, governments serve the regime and are, in fact, part of the regime. They have no connection or any interest in the ethnic history of a people, unless, of course, it's non-white. And that's something with postmodernism. Postmodernism is supposed to be this anti-imperialist, wildly and violently anti-racist movement that the minute the victim is white, as in South Africa, it's perfectly acceptable. Now, there are some communities that don't really require a government, but by and large, especially small communities, there needs to be a formal mechanism to protect the integrity, or else they'd be swallowed up. I mean, the worst you can consider it is a necessary evil, but it can be a positive good. And of course, there has to be informal and formal organizations in which tradition can find and design can find its expression. These are extremely important points here when you come to understand what Heidegger was getting at. None of this can you really find in academia today. This is so foreign to the academic bias. And I said this before. What happens when academia comes across a great scholar that you can't deny his importance, who is not liberal? Someone like Nikolai Gogol, Dostoevsky, Solzhenitsyn. I said this before. You either can ignore him. Well, that's out of the question because they're too important. You can condemn him to the skies and try to destroy the reputation, or you can completely reinterpret him in such a way that he becomes a good conformist liberal. And the men I just mentioned, you have all three of those going on at the same time. Now, I bring that up, all of this up, because we're talking about something like debate. How a society communicates over political issues that are not agreed upon. These are questions and people may get into fights about it. That can't be. If it's fundamental, then the society has already fallen apart. Debate implies an overwhelming consensus on pretty much everything else. Otherwise, debate's impossible. Debate is where it is now, completely administered by the powerful for their own interests. a debate, any kind of, whether you're talking about laws or what the courts are doing, foreign policy, has to come from inside. They have to possess a lot in common. And we talked about the nature of dwelling. At rest, the ethnos is dwelling with a capital D. In fact, the process of debate brings people closer, especially when a consensus is reached based on the shared understandings of the community. Well, that's something that you'll find in academia only so long, though, as that community is controlled. They run it. I always wondered, you know, when the anti-globalization protests, maybe years ago in Seattle, and it's run completely by the left. And they're talking about community. They're talking about these very quaint hunter-gatherer societies that are being destroyed. And they're talking about the agrarian community. I'm saying, what are they talking about? The typical life of the traditional agrarian community, they despise at every level. No, what they're talking about is a community that they define and that they control. Essentially, it would be a collective farm. You can never take them at face value. But legitimate discourse can only come into existence within a world, a life world, which is what design is about. In other words, social cohesion is critical to knowledge. It's a product of being. I think I did say this, but discourse outside of that is just warfare. I also mentioned death. From death comes Heidegger's most comprehensive conception of what free will is. Not only will he die, not only will you die and I die, but everything around us will. If we lived for eternity in the same way we do right now, I don't know what the incentive would be to do anything. Because we do have actually unlimited time. Death is an engine. Death provides us with a limit, a terminus. And it completely changes us. It completely changes, you know, animals don't know that they're going to die. They live for the moment. Well, we can't do that. More specifically, death eliminates the incentive for superficiality. You know, when someone says, oh, I don't want to do that. Life is too short. Oh, I'm not going to get involved with that. I'm not going to fight with this guy. Life is too short for that. That phrase comes directly out of what Heidegger's getting at here with death. It is too short, so I'm going to eliminate that which is a distraction, that which is insignificant, and focus on the things that are important. Death is extremely important to Heidegger, at least for this reason, and very few, other than Orthodox, you know, other than the monastic tradition, where death in front of us, keeping death in front of our eyes is important. Other than that, death as a philosophical category is extremely rare. The abstract ideologies have a struggle with death. Liberalism, Marxism, they don't know what to do with death because they're really not talking about actual workers or actual individuals. They're talking about the concept of a worker, the concept of an individual, and they probably don't even mean that. So death introduces a mode of thinking and acting where we have no choice but to put boundaries on whatever it is that we want to do within the tradition. Again, as I said, as far as poetry is concerned, this can be explicated expansively because of how poets use words. You have someone like Shevchenko for the Ukrainians, the Slavophiles among the Russians, the National Romantics among the Norwegians, you know, composers like Grieg. You could go to, you know, the great nations, or even the not-so-great nations, and you could point to the event, you could point to this series of intellectuals or poets that drew out this you know, kaleidoscope of folk tradition, what is truly essential. And of course, it has to correspond with the experience, especially the suffering of a group of people. But one of those abstractions is the standardized and bureaucratic state state in the sense of coercive agencies, what the FBI is today. This is not ethnicity. It's not local identity. It's not dwelling. The state exists only in the sense that it protects the ethnic group. An objective ideology is something that can be written on paper. But without the ethnos, the state serves only itself. And in our case, serves the regime as a whole, the oligarchs. So the ethnos, when you consider the many traditions and customs, everything from family life to religion, coming of age ceremonies, death itself, how immensely deep ethnicity is. It has tremendous, practically infinite content. It's being with a capital B as it developed over centuries, often in very rough conditions. Heidegger did look to Hitler because of the condition of Germany at the time, which never really gets discussed. People saw him, maybe not using Heidegger's terms, but this event, this flash, that finally there's some hope. Germany was actually torn apart, not just by Versailles, but also by the Stalinists, who took at least two sections, briefly, of Germany and tried to separate it, Bavaria and in the north. That's iffier, but at war with Germany and exclusively Jewish, especially in the Bavarian and then, as I mentioned, the Hungarian case. When I say words, you know, words on a page, that is the opposite of poetry. That's the prosaic mind. Mass man can't read poetry. He doesn't understand it. Words are just a means to an end. I want to communicate something, so I use the simplest words possible. That's all. It has no function than that. Again, that's a result of modern and postmodern alienation. That's where that comes from. You take a concept like justice. Again, I also think I mentioned this at least a few weeks ago. You could take justice, a word is used, never defined, but used in everyday discussion. We can take it as an aspect of being, of the ethnos, drawing out clear problems within the tradition. I mean, you could say, well, justice is giving to each according to his due, according to his merit. Well, that's fine. Of course, that could be a foundation, but it doesn't tell us much. The other way to take justice is as an abstraction, which results in vulgarity and ultimately serves the passions. I've said a million times how the Soviets viewed the working class. It had nothing to do with being in a class. It had nothing to do with being a worker. It had nothing to do with production. In fact, the Soviet government never had any grasp of how a worker functions, especially in its early years. The moment something becomes objectified in ideology, you get a lack of authenticity. You get bad faith. It becomes an anti-design. Heidegger argues in more practical terms that man is alienated and in deep crisis, especially in Germany, given the time period. And he is waiting for what he called a god, that's small G-O-D, that can reawaken the poetic, enable us to establish dwelling, and hence true representation. That is the connection between Heidegger and the National Socialist Party. Without that, especially, again, in times of crisis, that ethnos requires a leader. Without it, the traditions fall apart, and homelessness and vulgarity result. And the longer the crisis lasts, the worse it gets. Homelessness comes down to the abandonment of being and designed by men who should know better. It's the reduction of complexity to slogans or empty platitudes, taken at face value. The repression of being. But that repression of being is how the academics operate. They have their own design in many ways. And it's, you know, irrational. But being is another matter. And they refuse and maybe don't have the capacity to understand Heidegger or National Socialism in this respect. Man only handles real things. I know it was very difficult a few weeks ago going over the ready at hand and present at hand. His vocabulary is just disastrously frustrating. But as I said when we first started this series, that philosophy has to start with what we come across every day in our lives. And those things that have social value, of course, is our labor. And hence, we need tools and we need expertise. But when you read Hegel, you also realize that that's not enough. That has to be integrated into a functional society that can communicate in a single language. And then your work is not just for you, it's for the society as a whole, because what you're doing is socially necessary. When being is repressed, I mean, the left revolution does repress being. In loathing contempt, what remains? Ideology isn't strong enough to do anything. So many of the people who claim to be following an ideology, they just have a great excuse for their antisocial tendencies. Now, erroneously, being used to be this substance, this overall object that's common to all things that we come across. And as I said, that's the dyads of modernity, the one and the many, the individual versus the collective, freedom and determinism. Those dyads didn't have much of a solution, hence the crisis of the 20th century. The globe, the international, not the globalist order, but the international order is not abstract, but it exists only insofar as it's made up of specific nations and civilizations, each with its own design. As he wrote in 1947, of course, this is post-war, that homelessness now, that liberalism and Marxism now divided the entire world between them, homelessness is now institutionalized. But that can't be the destiny. Homelessness is alienation. It's in the ontological errors of modernity that man has become homeless. Freedom is seen not as submission to God, but as an abstraction, a license to do whatever you want. And you could say stupid things like, well, I believe in freedom insofar as it doesn't harm the freedom or rights of others. What the word harm means, of course, the courts still haven't fully laid out. Ultimately, it does come down to arbitrary decisions. One of the things that filled the gap as homelessness became the day-to-day lonely life of man is technology. Technology is not value neutral. This isn't about working with nature to assist human life. This is replacing it. Technology forces a transition of everything from an organic relationship to an inorganic or mechanized relationship. Something that is that being or especially design is organic. The ethnos is organic. This has grown up over time. Its depths can't fully be plumbed because so much of it is affective. The great cultures of the past, they're still surrounded by nature. They had gardens, flowers, and animals, and they became part of the mythology. They never broke with the rhythm of nature. And of course, they derived their day-to-day life from it, humanizing it. Man came from the earth, he returns to it, and all the symbolism that that contained. It's like an ecosystem. Man is taken from the earth and turned into a mechanism. Dwelling doesn't exist. Being doesn't. It's an anti-design. Technology radically changes man's relationship to space and time. The danger to which Europe has been forced, whether in his day or our day, is that the categories used, the concepts used to describe things have no relation to reality, because words have been totally separated from their initial meanings. They have no fixed definitions that could be used in any way, in an exoteric way, in an esoteric way. Let me quote from him here, and this concerns National Socialism. In the face of the essential homelessness of man, man's approaching destiny reveals itself to thought on the history of being in this, that man find his way into the truth of being and set out on this quest. Every nationalism. I do want to touch on postmodernism. Alexander Dugin just put out a great article on the subject as to how we can connect postmodernism on the one hand to Heidegger on the other. Of course, for Dugin, everything has to do with Heidegger. And he treats Heidegger the way I treat Hegel. And despite all of their protestations to the contrary, postmodernism does have a set of, does have an ideology, at least a set of principles. And Heidegger was part of this postmodern movement, although a very, very, you know, distinctive part of it. And a few things that he brings up, and I've touched on this briefly in the past, things along the lines of the autonomy of language. That language is not connected to anything but itself. Of course, for us, it's connected with the ethnic group in history, although they may not necessarily disagree with that. Phenomenology, because it has to do with the subject-centered nature of knowledge, how appearances appear to us. There is an interest in cultural pluralism, archaic societies. These guys are technically anti-globalist. Existentialism, of course. The grasp of the subconscious and psychoanalytic themes in general. One of the first things I ever came across in postmodernism, and it never left me, is that what we consider an individual object is never just a brute thing. It's made up of millions of other smaller objects. The thing about postmodernism is that it applies to the self, it applies to the state. Nothing is unified anymore. Now, I don't see these guys giving back their academic salaries. So that, I guess, is as real as you can get. But they do stress the idea of myth, although they're very unsure as to what they believe that is. Of course, this criticism of racism and ethnocentrism, well, we all know the exceptions there. One of the opportunities they show is this critique of the scientific image of the world, very much in Heidegger's vein. They condemn the modern, but also want to accomplish what it failed to accomplish. It saw the modern as fragile and arbitrary. And one of the ways it did this is rejecting the concept of progress. It's strange, because they can simply redefine the term, which is one of the convenient aspects of postmodernism not having any real functional definitions. There is no ground for action in postmodernism. But in their attack on the self, and of course we get posthumanism from this, the concept of the self, as well as the self's claim to freedom, or its psychological sovereignty, is attacked as an illusion. That's not teasing out something in modernism, it's the destruction of something in modernism. The self, in other words, is a relative thing. Now, almost nothing here. Is really outside of the concept of design and being. Because he's not going to say that design is an object. It's not a thing. In fact, it's the opposite of a unity, although it is unified. And many postmodernists have worked with Heidegger, although, you know, for very different reasons. The opportunity that postmodernism offers, I've been saying this for years, is that our enemies have been modernism, scientism, nominalism, liberalism, egocentrism, capitalism, socialism in the Marxian sense, materialism. It would be inconsistent for a postmodernist to accept materialism as true. Those words wouldn't even make sense in a consistent postmodern context. Now, deconstructing something is to show exactly what little bits create what you thought was a unified entity. But there is nothing in philosophy, even if there are certain elements of health to that, that Jewish media influence and left liberalism will not destroy and pervert for their own purposes. Marxism and postmodernism are enemies, unless, of course, it's convenient. Marxism has simply been redefined as concerning sexual and racial minorities, even when they're not the minority, against white people. And the whites or the new bourgeoisie and those other people are the homosexuals, whatever, are the working class. They're extreme sexual liberationists. So in that aspect, they're not disagreeing with modernism. But they, around the turn of the 20th century, this stuff came around. And it was one of those events in Heinecker's sense that shocked modernity itself. It's really hard to have two massive world wars where everything, the state, science, technology, is being used to slaughter the cream of European civilization, 30, 40 million people. Of course, only the 6 million are the ones we should care about. Belarus lost half its population, but we're going to concern, and of course, according to their own figures, they didn't lose a whole lot of people in World War II. 16,200,000, 16,400,000, all within this era. I don't know how that's possible. But you can't go through that and come out of it normal. All of these things began to be challenged, to believe in the science is infantile. Their own people don't believe that stuff anymore. It implies something that in the postmodern mind simply doesn't exist. But, and Dugin says this quite often, the revolutionary shift, I mean, modernism, by its very structure, capitalism, so these are revolutionary ideologies. And they're totalitarian ideologies as a result. I mean, when you have a scientific mentality from Newton or Galileo that completely revamps how even the tiniest things are perceived, that's by its very structure totalitarianism. We live under a totalitarian state, just the state itself, let alone the corporations. Although the state, of course, is mostly privatized. Stalin did not have that kind of power that the modern liberal democratic regime has. And there is no law. Courts do exactly whatever they want. And quite often, evidence doesn't mean anything. You have things on video. We've talked about that in the past. The postmodernity, just like modernity itself, becomes tyrannical. It's easy to accept the scientific view of the world, but postmodernity talks about these entities like numbers and regression as useful, and they reject them as useful. At the dawn of modernity, nominalism in people like William of Ockham and many others stressed the idea that only singular things exist. That's what a word is. A word is just a collection of singular things. And that's simple enough. Postmodernism says that's not going far enough. The individual things don't exist either. And what do you have left? You have words. Words that exist totally in their own world. This so-called structuralism, where language exists solely relative to itself. The danger there is where we're living right now. That those who have the power can define and redefine these terms as they see fit, even just amongst themselves. That the Israeli regime, what it's doing in Gaza and in the West Bank, as well as the Ukrainian regime, violently totalitarian and militarized societies, they are democratic. And that is the official point of view of corporations and the State Department and most universities. So when you think of what happens to the object, whether it be in Heidegger or in postmodernity, the singular nominalism didn't go far enough. The singular object, the singular thing that exists in its own right, even that is too much to defend. And as a result of that, they have completely rejected the idea of progress and hence the idea of utopia. This is not just relativism in the liberal sense, but even those principles underlying it, so many things like tolerance, are completely rejected. Relativism and democracy now is the imposition of left revolutionary ideology. The rejection of anything that's hierarchical or vertical, unless they control it, will be rejected. Relativism becomes an unquestionable dogma so long as it's not applied to things like the Holocaust or the sexual revolution. Anything traditional is considered a bourgeois fiction. It's very difficult for postmodernists to function because the words that they use can mean anything. Of course, they can't actually live that way. the concept of the generalization, no matter how tame it might be or how loose it might be, is rejected. Everything is subject to decomposition. Total liberation without any regard to anything else. For Heidegger's analysis of design, the attack on things like essence comes apace from the postmodern movement. Essence, for Heidegger, on the other hand, refers to the mission and destiny of a thing. If thinking isn't connected with the ethnos and engaging in the possibilities of the ethnic condition at a specific time and nation, at war, under warfare, or whatever it might be, then it's abandoned its essence. And essence is what something is supposed to do, the trajectory it's supposed to follow within design. That's not something that a postmodern could ever accept. There's a total destruction of anything called identity, including the very self that we're talking about. They're accidental. They're arbitrary things. Again, unless you're Jews, unless you're blacks in Africa, then, of course, you have all the identity you want. You know, Jews are the eternal exception here. The so-called oppressed minority, despite the fact that they rule with privileges that no aristocratic class ever had in the past, relativizing everything to the point where it doesn't exist anymore. When you destroy higher order reason in the sense of nous, when you reduce everything to how computers operate, everything is reduced to logic and numbers. And then you remove the very concept of the self that underlies all that, you get transhumanism. You get replacement. You get the mechanization, the robotization of life, which is central to the Great Reset. They have a whole, in the book, there's a whole section on it. This is almost a comic form of nihilism. And while there are certain connections between Heidegger and the postmodern, those tend to be on the margin. Dugin will say that one big area of overlap there is that the ethnic group and the civilization that it helps create, it's really hard to compare them. You can't say one is better than another unless you're very specific as to what you're talking about. It can't be this overall identity. And therefore, words and philosophy and value and all that is different from civilization to civilization. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. You certainly have, as is the case of the international, you have the reality of universal truths just manifest in a different way. Modernity only allowed universal truth when it was, in the language of science and based on quantity. But now even that has been removed by the postmodern. Heidegger was aware of these phenomena. He was very much aware of these phenomena. And if modern wasn't bad enough, now because of war, the complete collapse of standards and society as a whole, the only thing that's left is power and homelessness and alienation and destruction. And you better be in the right category. If you're a white male, you're in serious trouble, and it doesn't matter. If you're Jewish, you have an aristocratic position in society and can do and say pretty much as you please. I mean, the Jewish mafia functions completely without limit, despite the fact that these 90-year-old Italians in Brooklyn are getting arrested so that someone else can come in and take over their rackets. So what they claim to deny comes in through the back door, and Heidegger was aware of this. Poetry can mean nothing to them because words ultimately mean nothing to them. They have nowhere to stand to fight anything. Heidegger did. And that was the idea, the nation, the ethnos, manifests in design. And that is it for Martin Heidegger. I'm hoping this summary clarified a few things. Thank you, everyone. I always welcome your donations. And I'll see you on Patreon. Bye-bye.